Hey, Larry.
Hello, Andy.
How are you?
I'm recovering, getting better.
Oh, that's right. You were sick pretty bad. And this is take two. We recorded this a couple weeks ago, but I had some technical difficulties and all we heard was my side of the whole thing. And so we recorded for an hour and we lost it all. So here we are on try two. After some traveling, after illnesses and whatnot, here we are. So happy new year, Larry.
Well, thank you. Aren't we about halfway through the year now?
Almost. At least halfway through January.
So
we'll try to get on a more regular schedule of recording every week and putting out podcasts so all of the thousands of listeners can have their weekly digest of Andy and Larry speaking. And so tonight we're going to be talking about a probable cause hearing before retaking. And just to give you a quick teaser of what this covers is, let's say you've transferred your supervision to a new state, and in the new state, you commit some form of supervision violation. An example might be a curfew violation, or another example might be being around a minor beyond it just being incidental or accidental. But before we get into that, we did get an email comment from Mika, emailed us at registrymatters@gmail.com. And he says, I just found the podcast, and so far I'm enjoying the education on the registry. Great. Thank you very much for the comment. And if you'd like to leave comments, you can visit the website at registrymatters.co or email us at registrymatters@gmail.com. It's the new year, Larry, and I was wondering if you had any reflections on 2017 that you'd like to remember.
Well, I remember a great year for a number of reasons. We've had so many favorable court decisions, and it's just been great momentum building. We had the U.S. Supreme Court pronounce that the social media restrictions in North Carolina were too broad and therefore unenforceable. That was the case of Packingham, North Carolina versus Packingham. We've had a great case out of the Sixth Circuit of the United States Court of Appeals with Doe versus Snyder out of Michigan, where that Court of Appeals said that the continuous enhancement of the registration requirements did tip the registry to where it was inflicting punishment and therefore violated the ex post facto clause. We had the Menez decision in Pennsylvania, where the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said the same thing, that the enhancements that were done tipped what was a civil regulatory scheme to it was punitive. And so the Pennsylvania legislature, as is the Michigan legislature, trying to figure out how to redesign a non-punitive registry. Of course, if they would ask us here at NARSL, we'd be happy to help them do that. But they don't ever come to us. They go to the police and the prosecutors and end up with things that really should not be in a civil regulation. So we've got litigation pending a number of states as we do this podcast. There's challenges which NARSL, the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws, have signed on to as amicus partners. So it seems like the tide is turning, and that 2017 may have been a pivotal year in terms of that tide.
Awesome. And do you know of anything coming up for 2018 that we might be looking for?
Well, NARSL is making it our goal for 2018 to attach ourselves to at least three cases of importance. So we're constantly getting dozens, if not hundreds, of requests for people who want assistance, and we just don't have the resources. But we try to look at cases that would be precedential and have an impact on a large number of people. So we've attached ourselves to a case out of the Ninth Circuit regarding burden shifting out of Arizona. That's the May case, and the state has many states, not just Arizona, but have decided it's more convenient for prosecution to require that the defendant have the burden of disproving rather than the state having the burden of proving the intent. So burden shifting is a dangerous thing. So we've attached ourselves to that. International Megan's Law is always lurking out there. It's an issue that a lot of people are emotional about. They have passports going to be marked with a particular marking, so we're looking at what we might can do in that challenge. So, and then there's the continuous examination based on the Sixth Circuit decision, because that basically the U.S. Supreme Court said the Sixth Circuit got it right. that they used the right framework in their analysis, and that's when they refused to look at the Doe's case, the Doe's versus Snyder case. So all across the country, there will be sites to the attorneys will challenge registration schemes, and they will cite to that non-precedential decision. It's only precedential in the Sixth Circuit, but they will cite to that as persuasive authority. They'll cite to cases like Menez out of Pennsylvania. So there will be it's just great stuff that we have new tools to work with, and there'll be more and more challenges, and hopefully there'll be more and more successes. I mean, there's park restrictions cases pending in Illinois right now.
Right.
We just did a podcast about a number of cases in Illinois, but the lawmakers will never run out of things to force us to challenge. The day will never come when we will shut down, because as long as we have legislative bodies, there will be proponents of bad public policy will present to lawmakers things that should be done. And without strong opposition, often these things will be passed, and we'll be fighting another version. So there will be a proposal to reenact the registry in Pennsylvania, and hopefully the Pennsylvania group will be at the table pushing back and try to make sure they keep it as minimal as possible to be deemed a civil regulatory scheme. But law enforcement will try to push as far as they can to have a punishment scheme that they can call civil regulatory, and then it'll have to be challenged all over again if they go too far.
Right. Can we go back to the Arizona thing? And you said burden shifting. Can you? I'm not 100% sure I understand what you're talking about with the concept of burden shifting.
Well, as a general rule, the state bears the burden of proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And that's required to prove every element of the offense. But isn't it convenient if we pass a statute that says mere possession of a controlled substance is all the state has to prove? There's a number of ways where you could be in possession of something. You could be a parent of a teenager, and your car could be full of contraband, and you'd not have any idea that you were in possession of it. But the state can shift the burden to you to prove. They do that through what they call an affirmative defense, which an affirmative defense is something like in manslaughter or murder, the manslaughter. But when there's a killing, and you say, I did it, but I'm justified because of self-defense. That's an affirmative defense. So you're acknowledging the conduct. Well, if they have a strict liability or burden shifting in the statutory scheme, well, we found the contraband in your car. Then now it's the burden is on you to prove that you didn't know it was contraband or you didn't know it was in your car. It's very difficult to prove a negative.
Mm-hmm.
It should be the state having to prove that you knew it was contraband and you knew it was in your vehicle and that you knew you were in possession of it, not that you merely got caught. Well, that's what's happening with the Arizona statute. They have a statute where the mere touching of a person on their private parts is a sexual battery, but they don't require that touching be for a sexual gratification. It's just the mere fact that your hands are applied to those protected parts. And they say, but now you can assert your affirmative defense. You can say that you didn't touch the minor for sexual motivation, and you can convince the jury that you had the purest of intentions. But that's not the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be the state proving that you didn't have pure intentions, not the other way around. So the affirmative defense is a convenient burden shift, and that's what Arizona and a lot of states have done, is they've shifted the burden to the accused rather than to the state.
Isn't that going against innocent until proven guilty?
Well, you're still presumed innocent, but the burden for the underlying conduct, say the drugs are in your car.
Yeah.
Well, we found you dead to right with the drugs in your car, but you didn't know they were there, or you didn't know that it was drugs. Your kid may have told you that was something other than what it is.
Okay.
So the element of the crime is not required to be proved if they've shifted it. The state is supposed to prove they're supposed to prove that you had possession of. They're supposed to prove that you knew that it was
okay,
that you were possessing. And they're not, that when they shift the burden, they relieve the state or the government of its job to prove every element of defense beyond a reasonable doubt.
And why would they do this? Why would they shift this burden?
Well, it's easier to gain convictions.
Okay.
Very simple. You have a lot of people who believe that the criminals have the upper hand, and that they have all the rights, and that the police and law enforcement are seriously outgunned, and that the accused enjoy all the protections. So they come in with these ideas that, well, we can combat crime by making it easier to get convictions. So the easier we make it to get convictions, of course, the more convictions we're going to get. But we may convict people who shouldn't be convicted. that's the part that the general public doesn't understand, is we could make it a lot easier to convict a lot of people. There's a lot of things we could do. I use my drug analogy. If you want drugs out of cities, I'll tell you what you do. You let me form some Joe Arpaio Gestapo units, and we'll start going out on the city streets of your city around 8, 9 o'clock at night, and we'll run raids till about 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning at random houses, and we'll just show up and say, we want to search your house. And we wouldn't have to do that for a very long period of time. And that would be so many drugs flushed down the sewer that your water would be impure for years and decades to come. But you wouldn't want to live in a society like that. But the result would be good. We would get the drugs out of your cities. So the end results doesn't, you know, the means are not justified by the fact that you can get a favorable outcome. We're not supposed to do that in America. Yes, we can convict more people if we lower the burdens, but that's not America. Is supposed to be where it's difficult to convict people. The founders recognize the inherent power that government has over a citizen in terms of the mismatch of resources, and they deliberately designed a system that was supposed to be very difficult before you take a person's freedom away. And the victim advocates think that it's too difficult, so they come in and say it's too tough to convict people. Well, that's exactly what the founders intended it to be, difficult to take a person's freedom away.
And easier to get convictions just so you can put a notch on your battle chest that says, I got more convictions, therefore you should reelect me?
Well, I don't know if that's, I mean, that is a part of it, but there are people out there who genuinely believe that America is unsafe, even though the crime rate has been declining for 25 years, by and large, excluding pockets of exceptions like Chicago.
Sure.
But people believe that we're in an epidemic of crime, and therefore we need to do whatever it takes to make people safe. So it's not just the notch of the prosecutor, it's the clamor of the public saying, make me safe. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I don't care about those kind of people's rights. I care about being safe. And people like me, when I say, well, actually, you're pretty doggone safe now in America. I mean, you're safer. I would rather be alive today than any time in my life in terms of my safety. I feel safer now than I felt in the 70s when I was growing up, in the 80s. I feel way safer now because I know that statistically, the likelihood of me being a victim of a violent crime is far less now. And I know the technology that's apprehending suspects is far greater now. The observation, the technology that's out there looking at you every time you're outside your home, you're being watched by surveillance, whether it be a convenience store, whether it be a mall, wherever it is, there's surveillance. And that has suppressed criminality. And the forensics have evolved to where they can do facial recognition and figure out. So crimes are far more solvable now than the 70s.
Not to mention everybody is carrying around a little personal tracking device.
Well, that and they're carrying around picture devices to take pictures of
true.
I mean, it's just you're safer being alive today than you were in the good old days of the 1970s and 80s.
Well,
but for some reason, people don't understand that.
Well, so that ties into something that we talked about for a few minutes earlier, of that I am just infatuated with the term fake news, in that you said earlier that you think it's all fake news, but you collect multiple sources to try and filter through. Maybe this is too sensationalized. Maybe this is exaggerated. And then you kind of come up to some filtered version somewhere in between. And while I agree with you, that doesn't make the news fake. It just makes it not pure, but that doesn't make it fake. There are cases where there is a legitimately fabricated story, which I would then consider fake. But just because someone reports something that is exaggerated or from their slant, that doesn't make it fake.
I would agree with you on that. And probably me saying fake news, that it's all fake news, it's probably not a good choice of words. Probably saying that there's a lot of bias in almost all news.
Of course there is.
And that's what I was intending to communicate. And I'll give you an example. We had a case here that's just unfolding in my state where an 18-year-old had consensual sex in his vehicle with a 14-year-old, and he happens to be a coach at a high school. And at 18, I don't think you could have an educational degree, so he's probably an assistant,
right?
Some type of assistant coach. But he's coaching cheerleaders at a high school, and he had a consensual sexual encounter with a 14-year-old, and he's 18, and they have so demonized this, and the prosecutors demanded he be held without bond. And he's being held right now without bond. Hopefully that doesn't hold up too much longer when the judiciary has time to run the analysis of this case. But he's been so demonized, and they've made it like that this is something that's just so bizarre that it can't be believed. Well, I hate to tell you folks out there, how many of us say we never had sex in our cars when we were 18 years old, 19 years old, or that age range? And he had a consensual encounter with someone who really was not age appropriate for him, because there was a greater than a 4 year age difference, which is where the protection of our law stops. If it's 4 years or less, he would have been protected. But anyway, they've made the news. It's a true story. He did get arrested, but they've made it sound like if he's not detained, that there will be some inordinate amount of danger posed to the public.
Right.
Well, folks, be honest and overcome your biases. Do you think that a person who has hormonal rages that's 18 years old and has consensual sex with a teenager, who stated clearly in the police report and begged the detective to say, "Hey, we're doing this because we want to do this," can you really say that you think that person that presents a danger to the community needs to be held without bond? That's nonsense.
Just to make a counterpoint, the people that had the 13 kids shackled, they got $14 million bond, something like that.
Probably not likely they'll post it, but I get your point that there was a bond set, and that's a different
Yes.
state.
Right.
And some states don't allow no bond, and we didn't allow no bond until just this year. So,
Having a bunch of kids shackled and starved to death, you get bond, but have sex with a 14-year-old and you don't get bond. That's my point.
Well, even the shackling, though, that there's a presumption of innocence that goes with that person. They're supposed to be entitled to a reasonable bond under our Constitution. There's no presumption of guilt. There's a presumption that they're not guilty.
I'm with you, but again, having sex. Well, I get, did they catch him? So there's, I mean, but there's still a presumption.
They caught him in the act, but
Oh.
there's still the presumption of innocence. He could put forth some defense that hasn't been thought of that might work. But
He slipped. It was the affirmative defense. He didn't mean to.
well, but when you hold a person in custody for, it's supposed to be to protect the community,
Yes.
and that no set of conditions would reasonably assure his appearance at court and keep the community safe. I don't see, unless you're willing to acknowledge that you posed a threat to the community when you were having teenage sex, what threats he posed to the community.
Sure.
I mean, you could, as a condition of release, you could say you can't go on any school property.
Right.
You could put a GPS monitor to make sure he
Yes.
follows that condition.
Follow curfews, all those other things. Right.
But I just don't see how it's such a threat to community to have normal sexual urges. I'm puzzled by that.
So then who is the one that's clamoring to have the DA go off and do those things?
It would be the citizens of that judicial district who have been told by everyone that we've got to crack down hard on people who exploit children. So as far as they're concerned, doing the job, the statute's on the books. He's doing his job. He's enforcing law. By golly, they're happy with it. Now, it could get enough public uproar. Could you remember there was a case in Florida where there were similar facts, where it was an older, it was a two females, and well, one student was younger, and I think one was like 18, kind of like the same age pattern we have here, as best I recall. And the gay rights community came in big and said, "Hey, you shouldn't prosecute her. You're singling her out because this is a homosexual related, this is a female on female." And they did get the prosecutor to back off and be much more reasonable. And I think they came up with a misdemeanor solution to that case. But the prosecutor is answering to the voters. If the voters were calling his phone right now and saying, "How dare you? Why are you charging this man?" those charges would quickly find a way to be resolved. But that's not what they're hearing. The media has sensationalized this, and they do this because that's what the public want to hear. Why do you think we cover Princess Diana 24/7 when she was alive? Because that's what the people want.
Right, because it makes news, makes ratings, which gives them advertisers, which gets them money.
That's our great capitalist system. People seem shocked when capitalism responds to what it's designed to do.
Yes.
The broadcast media is for-profit entities. They're
Yes.
designed to make profit. And you're shocked when they do what it takes to drive their ratings so they can make money. Why are you so shocked? That's what they do.
Which then that leads to a really nice conversation about removing the immediate profit from the news cycle. I think I worded that well.
Well, but that's where they do the flip-flop. The
Yes.
people who so decry the bias of the media, then they turn and I said, well, okay, well, let's talk about some alternatives. Do you want to have more money for public broadcasting? Oh, no, we don't want
Right,
that.
exactly. That's where I was
Well,
going.
do you want to consider maybe some restrictions on mass ownership so we don't have these
Okay.
media empires that are so obligated to fulfill Wall Street's expectations on profits? Do you want to divest? No, we can't do that. And I said, well, do you want to bring back any type of equal time doctrine, any fairness doctrine? No, you don't want to do that. I said, well, then you're kind of stuck with it.
Right, you've painted
Well,
yourself
we've
into a
got,
corner there.
yeah, we've got a problem. It's kind of like the gun problem. We've got a problem that a lot of people die at multiple times any other nation on earth at the hands of guns, and there's absolutely nothing we can do about it. We're powerless. It's in our Constitution. The Second Amendment's there. And if you dare talk about doing anything regarding guns, you can't do it. So we're powerless. I mean, we're going to have mass shootings. You and I are dead because there's nothing we can do. There's nothing we can do about the bias in the media because it's a for-profit business and it's going to be there. And that's nothing. Nothing else is going to change.
And until we would then change how we watch that or tell them to change what their sponsors start dropping, like Hannity's had a bunch drop because he's kind of gone off the deep end, then things don't change because they're still being
That's
rewarded
good.
with the dollars. And that's what they're going after.
That's correct.
All right. So moving on, I wanted to try and throw in something where we cover something along the lines of current news events. And I went into this thinking something different until you kind of set me straight a little bit. But this article comes from Reason Magazine that says Fourth Circuit approves imprisonment of sex offender convicted of a non-existent crime. And what I would like from you on this is, while you may or may not know the details of the article, but I think the concept in general is where your expertise will be useful. William Welsh has been in prison for 7 years, though he was convicted of a crime that everyone agrees he did not commit. That's okay, according to a federal appeals court, because Welsh is not really a prisoner. He's a patient, lawfully committed under a federal statute that allows indefinite detention of sexually dangerous persons. In 2011, Welsh, who had repeated convictions for child molestation, sodomy, and sexual abuse dating back to 1979, pleaded guilty to violating the SORNA Act by failing to update his registration information when he moved from Oregon to Belize. 5 years later, in an unrelated case, the Supreme Court ruled that the SORNA provision under which Welsh was convicted did not require a sex offender to notify the state where he used to reside when he moved to another country. But by then, Welsh, whose 2-year prison sentence would have ended in 2013, had been deemed sexually dangerous and sent to a treatment program at the Butner Federal Correction Institution in North Carolina. So, what I'm getting out of this is he's a repeat offender and he moves out of the country and then he gets nailed for something for a 2-year prison sentence and they deem him a sexually dangerous person and they send him off to indefinite detention?
That's what I'm getting out of this, Andy.
So, the conversation we should have then is about civilly committing people for anything from a sexual crime or to other mental illnesses, say you're in danger of suicide, let's say.
Well, I think it's good to point out in this case, the reporting is a little bit skewed at the beginning because everyone doesn't agree that it's a crime he did not commit. If everyone agreed, then he wouldn't have ever been convicted of a crime. So the players at the time that of the prosecution of him on the SORNA violation agreed that it was a crime, that they had jurisdiction, and that he either pled to violating SORNA or he was convicted. In most cases, since that was a federal case, he probably pled to violating SORNA. And so subsequently, in an unrelated case, there was a person who had moved to the Philippines or somewhere, and I don't remember
Right.
the exact details of that case,
It was from
but the Supreme,
Kansas, to the Philippines.
yeah, the Supreme Court ruled that there was no continuing duty to report for a person who was outside the country. So at the time he did the failure to report, it was a crime as far as everybody was concerned. So now subsequently, it may not be a crime, but that Kansas may have not rendered his conviction invalid. So what happened, having not read all the stuff about this case, now become aware of it, what happened was as he was serving his time and as he neared the end of his prison sentence, they looked at his background and they may have considered his conduct while he was in the BOP custody and decided to seek civil commitment on him under the standards which exist to allow for a person to be involuntarily committed to a treatment facility or so-called treatment facility. And there was a due process separate that had nothing to do with the criminal case of the SORNA violation, which he would have had to go through in order for him to be committed. And that process ran its course. And what the appellate court is saying is that whether or not you were convicted, your conviction for the SORNA violation is valid, you do have enough evidence to suggest you have a mental abnormality that shows that you're a sexual, a risk of sexual offending, and you meet the federal criteria. So therefore, your commitment is valid. Whether or not that conviction is valid is irrelevant. That's what the court was apparently saying. I'd like to read the decision. I don't know about it, but that's what it sounds like they're saying.
To say that one person is worthy of doing civil commitment just by going to prison, just by you committing some sort of crime up front, wouldn't it be possible for psychologists and prosecutors to argue that you have demonstrated that you are not safe for society? Therefore, that is why we need the registry, lifetime registration, civil commitment for anybody who's ever committed a crime, sexual or not?
Well, the commitment, my state doesn't have that particular type of civil commitment. All states do have a form of civil commitment, but sexual offender specific civil commitment we don't have. So I don't have to be familiar with the statutory schemes because we don't fight that here. But what typically they have language in there that the person has to have a mental abnormality that of a sexual nature. Now they don't say a mental disease or defect. They say a mental abnormality generally, and that raises that person's threat level that they will engage in for a dangerous behavior or something to hurt the community. Well, just because you've had a sexual offense doesn't make you of that criteria that you present a danger to the community at large. So every case would not qualify for those standards, but unfortunately too many cases do qualify. And there's a lot of people committed. They're in sex offender specific civil commitment. They're being nothing but warehouse, and it's a tragedy.
Up north, Midwest, Michigan, Minnesota, I've heard of a place that has
Minnesota
35 or something people that have, and like two have been released in 20 or 30 years or something.
Oh, Minnesota has a whole lot more than 35. They have hundreds.
Okay.
Hundreds.
And where does that draw the line of being unconstitutional?
Well, in the case of the Minnesota, it was recently challenged, in fact, and the trial court judge found that it did cross the line and ordered the state revamp its procedures and figure out how to start getting people out of there. But the state had a right to appeal, and they did. And the Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit reversed the trial judge and said, no, the fact that you're committed does not entitle you to be released. There's no guarantee that you'll ever get better. The theory of civil commitment is that the person is committed long enough to treat them back to safety. And once, I mean, John Hinckley, who tried to assassinate President Reagan, he's been released from civil commitment.
Right.
Now, it took him a very, very long time because of the importance of the people he shot. He shot five people.
Right.
And the importance of the president, the press secretary, and the three, the Secret
James
Service.
Brady.
And Brady was the press secretary, and then there was Secret Service, and then there was D.C. Metro Police that were shot along in that escapade. So, but he's been released. The thrust of civil commitment is to bring a person to the point where they can be safely released. Well, the trial judge, the SOTA program, was not doing that because the evidence showed that virtually no one had been released.
Right. I
remember if it was one or two, but it was either no one or only a handful of people had been released. But the Court of Appeals said, no, you're not entitled to release. You're entitled to a process where you theoretically could be released, and that process exists in this commitment program. You have a review process. It is adequate. It meets the constitutional standards because there is a theory that you could be released. The fact that you and some of those people that were bringing the charge, had the challenge, had not been committed for excessively long period of time. And so they said it was speculative. They assumed that you're not going to get out because you haven't been in long enough to know whether you're going to. You haven't even tried to get out. So how can you say you won't get out when you haven't even tried? So they said it did not violate the Constitution, and they relied on a U.S. Supreme Court decision to come to their. So civil commitment is something that's going to be difficult, because the mere act of civilly committing someone is not unconstitutional. Every state has a way to commit a person if they're a danger.
And the example that I think most people would relate to would be somebody climbs up on top of a water tower threatening to jump. So the police get you down, they come up and snatch you, and they escort you down, and then you get civilly committed, and you'd be civilly committed until doctors deem you to be not a threat to you or the people around you.
That is correct. But it's clear in the regular standard civil commitment that the goal is that person's release. With sex offender commitment, that the motivation underlying sex offender commitment is a little more sinister. It's to actually extend the period of incarceration.
Right.
They magically discover that the person needs mental health care until after they've served. And then, having alleged they were completely competent, responsible in every way mentally, so that they could be viably stand trial and be convicted in the criminal system, then they magically do a flip-flop, and they decide that the person is needing mental health service. And then they put them in facilities that scarcely resemble mental hospitals, mm-hmm. and they resemble more like prisons. Now, mental hospitals, since they are holding people that are dangerous, they do resemble locked facilities.
Right.
But generally, a patient gets to wear their own clothing. They don't get prison numbers. They don't wear jumpsuits, and they see medical personnel regularly, and they get medical reviews, and the treatment teams try to figure out what it will take to get that person stable enough and safe enough to where they can be released. So if you were on top of the water tower and the police had to escort you down, in most jurisdictions, you would be taken to a mental facility. There are jurisdictions where there's no such facilities, and they take you to the jailhouse. But in most instances, you'd be hauled to a psychiatric facility for an observation period. And during that observation period, if they could stabilize you enough where they don't really need a civil commitment order, the statute just permits a brief detention, then the person would be released. But if they can't stabilize the person, then they seek various periods of commitment, from short term to even longer term. But there's a robust process there where that person has the right to be represented, and there has to be convincing to a court that this person needs to be committed. So civil commitment in this day and age is very difficult for the normal processes. Therefore, we have far fewer people committed against their will in this country than we had in the 1960s, 50s, and even 70s, when the protections weren't as great. But we don't seem to have those same protections for the states that civilly commit people for sexual offenses. It seems to be a lot easier to commit them and much more difficult for them to get out. So therein lies the problem.
The way you word that, though, is that it's a very soft, cushy, not the sex, sexual confinement one, but of somebody needing mental help, and they bring you to a place that is designed to help you get out, to get better so that you can be released, and overlay that on top of that you have an 18-year-old having sex with a 14-year-old in a parked car, and that person is portrayed as being the second coming of Satan.
So, well, is there a question?
No, there's not a question there. It's just there's one side of it that sounds like they're very interested in making you better. And even though this person has demonstrated that they're harmful, yet you have something that is kind of a natural biological process, and they demonize that one.
Oh, I see your point. But America has a phobia about sex more than other nations.
Absolutely.
Western nations like that, because people say, well, have you ever been to the Middle East?
Yes,
have you ever?
Absolutely.
But in terms of Western nations, which we like to hold ourselves up to, you don't have these attitudes in Germany. You don't have these attitudes, and you don't have them in Norway, Sweden, Denmark. We have a fixation about sex that's unbelievable, and I don't know how to explain it. I think part of it's religiously driven, and the conservative nature of a lot of our country has something to do with it. But we are very fixated on sex, and it's a fairly normal phenomenon.
So it's been going on for a while anyway.
It has.
All right. Well, let's move on to the probable cause hearing. So at the probable cause hearing, the what?
I'm playing with you.
Oh, don't do that. Messes me up. All right. So we've transferred our probation to a new state, and now we've done something that puts us under the thumb of the supervision authorities in the new state. And we are, I guess we are under the threat of being sent back where we came from. And you have told me that there is a process that people frequently waive their right to, and they just get sent back home. And that's probably not a huge big deal if you move from the northern part of one state into the next state above you, and you're in the southern part where it's just maybe 100 miles or something like that. It's probably not that big of a deal. But suppose you took a job and you moved halfway or all the way across the country, and now you find yourself in this situation. And we were going to go into some depth on what your rights are in having this probable cause hearing.
I do like talking about the probable cause hearing. Let's talk a little bit about the interstate compact so we clarify for the listeners. We're talking about those who have state convictions. We're not going to deal with the federal system for this discussion because it's a different process. But if a person gets convicted of an offense in Florida and they would like to live in Oregon, there's a process by which they can do that. And that's the interstate compact for adult offender supervision when we're talking about an adult. And a compact is think of it in terms of a treaty between nations. It's a treaty between the states. So this interstate treaty that is in operation, and we've had an interstate compact for, I think, since 1937, dealing with interstate transfer of probation parolees. The compact we're under now is relatively new. It's been operating about 15 years. Prior to that, there was an interstate compact for probation parole, the ICPP. But in this interstate agreement between the states, there are processes there that the offender is entitled to that are very important. And one of those is the right to a probable cause hearing. So if that Florida offender is living in Oregon and they violate the conditions of supervision, be they Oregon's conditions or Florida's conditions, there's a process by which they end up having to go back to Florida. Because remember, they're Florida's offender. And Florida sentenced them, and only Florida can revoke them or take any steps on their supervision. Oregon is only acting as an agent for Florida under this treaty. So there's a process that we need to clarify that entitles that offender to a probable cause determination if their probation is in jeopardy of being revoked by Florida. So oftentimes that is not understood, and that offender doesn't get that probable cause hearing. And it can be very dangerous because they end up back in Florida without having had at least a preliminary determination in Oregon that they violated their conditions of supervision. And then witnesses and important evidence that could have been available to assist them in Oregon won't be available in Florida. So that's why that process exists, to have a preliminary determination made in the receiving state. When we say receiving state, we're talking about the state which the probation supervision, the parole supervision was transferred to. The sending state would be the state where the offender originated with conviction. So Florida would be the sending state in this illustration, and Oregon would be the receiving state.
Okay. And when you do have this hearing, there is a term, I think this is similar to when you go to court for a first-time offense, if I'm describing this the right way, there has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And I believe you've said that there is a different standard that must be met in these probable cause hearings.
That is correct. And the standard being that there is probable cause. That's the standard.
That's the actual term for it?
That's the actual standard. When you talk about evidentiary standards, you're talking about a litany of them. You start with reasonable suspicion, which is about the lowest, and then you have probable cause, which is slightly higher. And then you have a preponderance evidence, which is typically what's required in a civil case where it's slightly more than 50% when you tip the scale. And then we've got clear and convincing evidence, which is a pretty strict standard, but it's not the ultimate standard. The gold standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what's required to convict a person of any proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So in order for this offender that's in Oregon to be forced to return to Florida, the Oregon system is supposed to conduct a hearing and determine that there is probable cause to show that there has been a violation before that person is subject to a full-blown revocation proceeding in Florida.
Can you give me an example of what proof of a probable cause would be?
Well, it's not crystal clear, but it's sufficient credible evidence to convince a hearing officer that you probably what was alleged. It doesn't have to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
Can we use O.J. Simpson?
I suppose we
use O.J. Simpson that he probably committed the crime?
If that were the standard, then yes, he would have been convicted, but that was not the standard of reasonable doubt.
Right. So
But there was probable cause, yes.
So I bet you would find the majority of people believe he was guilty.
Well, if they were doing a probable cause determination on O.J., they would have had plenty of evidence to achieve that standard.
Okay.
Because all they would have had to have shown was that there was enough evidence to connect him to this event and that show that he probably did.
Okay, and that would be the standard. So they just say, yeah, he was there. People saw him there. We can't prove he did it, but we believe he did it. So he probably did it. Therefore, he gets kicked out.
He would. Well, in the case of initiation of proceedings, so like with a probable cause is the standard that's required to initiate a criminal proceeding against someone brand new. So either by a grand jury or by a preliminary hearing, most jurisdictions establish a threshold showing that the accused is connected to the offense, that there's some connection, that there wasn't a criminal act occurred, and that there's evidence to suggest that this person probably did it, and that'll suffice as enough to move the case along.
All right.
So,
I'm assuming that people have heard of the OJ case, and obviously he wasn't found guilty. So I'm trying to come up with some sort of delineation on these five different levels of standard to see where the OJ would have fit on that scale.
Well, he was able, when they did the civil case against him, the civil standard was only clear and convincing, and the civil jury found that he was responsible for the deaths of Ron Goldman and Nicole Simpson Brown, whatever her name was. They found that there was sufficient. So the intermediate standard of the civil court was sufficient. So that was done, and he was found liable for their deaths.
Interesting. Okay, so now you're in custody. So you're sitting in the local jailhouse, and I guess the DA or assistant DA or somebody's, like maybe even your public defender is going to come to you and start hitting you with these forms to say you're signing waivers to go home and so forth. What are your rights for being in the receiving state for you to slow that whole thing down so that you do get this probable cause hearing?
Well, it's interesting you describe it that way, because that's one of the better scenarios if they actually came to you. What frequently happens, and I can't give you specifics on how frequent this happens, but there's enough times where this happens that people just languish, because in order for a person to be brought before a tribunal, brought before a court, there has to be a mechanism that causes it. So some jails are directly tied to the courts. And the minute someone pops up on the jail roster, the courts are aware that that person needs to be dealt with. There are others where that doesn't happen. So you'll have a person who will sit in custody. They'll be taken into custody on a rest and hold by a probation officer. And some states empower their probation officers to do a rest and hold on a probation violation. So they'll be taken into custody on a rest and hold. And since there's no case in that jurisdiction, they're just on a PV hold. They're sitting on the jail roster, and the local courts aren't looking at them, so they could sit there for quite some time and nothing would happen. Or where somebody did discover them, what frequently happens is that there's a misunderstanding. They'll pop up on a jail roster of being in custody, and since they don't know what to do with them, this interstate compact is relatively new, and there wasn't a careful process establish what states should do with their interstate offenders. They treat it like an extradition. So the jail that's connected to a court sees this person in custody, and they'll open an extradition file. They'll say, "Well, this is a fugitive extradition." Well, it isn't. It's not that at all. And a fugitive extradition proceeding is far different than a retaking under the interstate compact.
Okay, and I'm picturing fugitive. I'm picturing Harrison Ford. And the bus crashes and he escapes, and now he's a fugitive from justice. That's what I picture when you say fugitive.
Well, that's one fugitive. Anybody who's wanted in another state, if you lived in Florida and you decided that after committing a series of crimes that you were smart enough to go undetected, and you left Florida, and eventually Florida figured out that you were the suspect, and they established probable cause, went to a judge, I went through whatever the established process to get to get a probable cause determination to initiate proceedings, they could issue a warrant for your arrest, and you'd be a fugitive, even though you didn't escape. The fact that a state wants you, there's a demanding state, and you're not in that state's custody, that causes you to be a fugitive.
Right.
But you're not a fugitive when you're in interstate compact, because the state which has you under supervision has voluntarily given you permission to be outside their borders to be supervised through a designated agency that's approved to supervise you. So there's no fugitive status. So in a fugitive proceeding, the only issue that's being contested, there's actually a couple of issues: your identity and whether the demanding state that wants you back has gone through the proper process of putting their papers together, got the governor's approval, and their paperwork's in order. You've got far more rights in a retaking proceeding under interstate compact, because there's probable cause needed to send you back. There ain't no probable cause needed for a fugitive extradition, because the state that wants you has already met their probable cause determination and determined that they want you. And under the full faith and credit clause, the state that you're in, which is called the asylum state, they have a duty to use the processes to get you back to the demanding state that you're a fugitive from justice from. So it's completely different in terms of what issues are being looked at. But what happens is, a lot of people are presented with extradition waivers, and they're told, well, why don't you just go ahead and go back to Florida and get this all straightened out there? Well, by that time, they've been sitting in the Clackamas County Jail for 103 days, and they haven't seen anybody, and they're so happy to get out of county jail that they signed the extradition. And it's not an extradition, but as soon as they sign the extradition, then a process goes in place to transport them back to Florida, and they're gone. And then they have a very difficult proceeding in Florida, because they're back and their witnesses are out in Oregon. That's the problem.
Right. And just for a procedural part, who comes and gets you and who pays for it?
Well, it would be the state that's demanding your return. So the Florida authorities, it varies from state to state. Sometimes it's the county that wants you. Sometimes it's the state. But
it's a long trip.
Well, the extradition has evolved to where it's a lot cheaper now for there are prison transport companies that have sprung up. Capitalism has an amazing ability to create processes. And as the criminal crime wave escalated in the 70s and 80s, of which it wasn't really as much a crime wave, but a lot more people were being extradited, big business realized that there's a demand for moving offenders around. So there's a lot of prisoner transport companies that transport. In the old days, you would have had one or two deputies. Law enforcement officers would fly out to Boulder, Colorado. They would shackle you up and take you on an airplane and fly you back. Well, they don't do that hardly anymore. You have to be very high profile. They have to want you quick to do that. Otherwise,
man, you're going to sit in a van or Greyhound bus for 3 weeks.
That's exactly. You're going to get picked up in Boulder by a transport company. They're going to drive a full day, and they're going to lodge you in a jail somewhere along the way where they can pay the minimal price to do that. And eventually, after they meander their way around the country, it may be three times the amount of time it would have taken to drive directly before you get there. And you may have stayed in several county jails before you get to the ultimate. It's a horrendous process.
And you're going to be eating packouts.
Yep. So this probable cause hearing is tragic that people are not getting them and the processes are not clear. But it's something we're working on, at least in my state. We're trying to do a better job of making sure attorneys know that it's a probable cause hearing that you're entitled to. It's not an extradition.
Can't just broadcast PSA announcements go out to like NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers? Don't they all know about it?
I'm sorry to say that they don't.
I thought attorneys knew everything.
Well, unfortunately, they don't. So the judges don't know a lot of this. The prosecutors don't know a lot of this. The nuances of the interstate compact, and there's just really a deficiency across the board, and it's to the detriment of the offender.
Got it. Is there anything else on that you want to cover?
Well, I'm expecting that we're going to get inquiries about it, because I know that some of the listeners are out there that have transferred their supervision. So certainly I would say that I'm recognized as being one of the more knowledgeable parties. So if they send comments to us, I'll be happy to try to answer their question. Now, if they're sitting in jail, they're probably not going to email us comments, but people that have either experienced this or know someone's experienced this, I would certainly be willing to try to to help anyone understand that there are due process rights under interstate compact, and don't just voluntarily throw up your hands and go back to a state across the country. It's so vital, particularly when there's a great distance involved. If you're in one of these small in New England states where that you're talking about a much smaller travel time, if you cross the border from the eastern shore of Maryland into Delaware, but you're talking about great distances many times, and it's an extreme hardship to be shipped back if there wasn't probable cause to justify it.
Got it. Incidentally, going back to the capitalism discussion, you and I are, I don't know what, 1,200, 1,300 miles apart, and we are talking literally for free. And recently, a company that provides services to inmates, you can email into the prison, and it's 35 cents to mail in. I don't know what the character limit is, but it's like, let's say it's 500 words. So you can send 500 words and it's 35 cents. If not, they charge you, quote unquote, 2 stamps to send an email. It's ridiculous.
Well, there was, I'll get on a political discussion there. Under the previous president, there was an effort to try to suppress these excessive costs. Phone calls are a big profit for correctional institutions. And what we have is we have state regulation and we have federal regulation. So calls that originate and terminate within a state are regulated by the state regulatory authorities. Those are referred to as intrastate calls. And then those that go across state boundaries are interstate calls, and they're under the federal regulatory authorities. So the Obama Federal Communications Commission put significant restrictions on the cost of phone calls, to the point that the communication companies were upset about it. So they challenged those in court, and they won that the FCC. In the meantime, the new administration has gotten a much more favorable FCC for business. So those any reconstitution of those regulations were not likely to happen. So you have extreme exploitation of inmates, but it makes the taxpayers happy, because when you go out and tell the voters, well, I'm going to tell you one thing, we don't mollycoddle these criminals. By golly, they help pay for their upkeep, and we charge them for using the telephones, and we get a portion of that, and it helps pay for the cost of their incarceration. Most voters are very satisfied with that.
Yeah, except it's not the inmate that's paying for it; it's the family that's paying for it.
Right, but the voters were happy that those inmates were helping offset the cost of their incarceration. And it'll only be when there's a massive number of people calling elected officials and say, how dare you charge somebody $8 for a phone call when calls for all practical purposes are free.
Mm-hmm.
But the workaround, of course, the savvy people work around this. They get a cell phone, which you couldn't have done years ago. You get a cell phone issued in the state, so it's an intrastate call. So if you've got a person incarcerated in Florida, you'll get a Florida error coded phone number, even though you're nowhere near Florida. That makes it a subject to intrastate regulatory authorities.
Yep.
So if you're in a state that has a robust regulatory scheme that has put such as my state has, I think they're limited to like $1, $1.50 a call here on correctional facility calls, then you get a local phone number, and then that keeps the cost of those affordable. But it's one of the many tragedies of the justice system. There's money being extracted all across the board from people who don't have it.
Yeah.
And it's a cycle of viciousness where they assess what sounds like a modest fee on a minor infraction, but then when the person doesn't can't pay the modest fee, $100 in court cost and $50 for a victim impact fee and all this kind of stuff, it sounds like when you get to the grand total, it's $272. Doesn't sound like an insurmountable amount, but you're also paying for the cost of your probation. You're also paying for the cost of your GPS monitor. You're also paying for the cost of your polygraph. You're also paying for restitution, and you're also relegated to minimum wage jobs in many instances. And these things are insurmountable. So then the person ends up incarcerated again because they can't pay all these cash register machines that are out there collecting for them. And it's one of the tragedies of our capitalist system.
I totally understand where you're coming from. Well, we are right at an hour of recording, so I think we can, unless there's other things you want to cover, I think we can call it a night.
Well, I'm glad that we could get something recorded. I'm sorry for our listeners that we've been off the air for about a month. So.
Yes, we have, and we will work to correct that. And as always, Larry, I so greatly appreciate your time and expertise, and I will talk to you very soon.
Thank you, Andy.
Have a good night. Bye.
Good night.
Have a question? send an email to registrymatters@gmail.com, or you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. You can also leave comments on the website registrymatters.co. This is episode 8. Music is Downtown by bensound.com. If you like the show, please share it with someone. We would appreciate it if you did. Thanks for listening.